It's a great kavod for me to introduce someone who's a rav. He has his own shul in Flatbush. He's the senior rabbinic coordinator. He's in charge of the European desk at the OU. And he's also one of our wine experts. I'd like to call on Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz Shlita to speak about the production of kosher wine and liquor. It's going to be a PowerPoint presentation, and I hope you'll include, I think, the number one whiskey issue is sherry casks. I hope that that will be part of his presentation. Rabbi Nachum Rabinowitz Shlita.
Thank you very much, all the attendees. I see that the president of the shul has welcomed us so graciously, knows how to pair wine with meat, and that's what the topic of our conversation will be tonight. Kosher wine, how it happens, and we've added a visual audio accompaniment to sort of give a taste, a flavor of what goes into making kosher wine, to give you a perspective from the field. This week's Parsha, in fact, the elephant mentioned a number of references in the Parsha, so I'll briefly mention Yosef HaTzadik sent to his father, to Yaakov Avinu, the Tuv Mitzrayim. He sent him from the best of Mitzrayim, which Rashi identifies as being Yayin Yosham, old wine that Rashi says, Shadas Zakenim Noicha Hemenu, that older people have an appreciation for. I heard from once from Adam Godel, and I think he didn't mention this Rashi, but perhaps he says that, you know, when we like food, if we enjoy a piece of meat or if we enjoy ice cream or whatever, you know, tickles our fancy, he says that's taiva. It's basically, it's the desire for, he says, fine wine, he says, that's already chachma. He says, that's already, das kenim leicha hemena, that's something which, you know, is a finer type of a product and the way it's made and how it's aged. And today, even in our community, which until relatively recently didn't have that many choices in kosher wine, today that's changing, and there is already a lot available from, you know, all the wine regions around the world, the major wine regions. There is kosher wine available, and I'd like to sort of share with you what goes into making wine kosher. I think there's a lot of knowledge about what goes into it, but this you know, sort of will provide a hands-on perspective of what happens. So tonight's presentation is a review of the halacha, technical issues that go into wine, grape juice, and hopefully at the end we'll also touch on, I understand that there's an appreciation today, not just for wine, but for fine liquor as well. And we'll talk about some of the kashrus issues that present themselves for that. When organizing a kosher wine production, we have not one mashgiach. A mashgiach is a supervisor. This is not an issue of a supervisor. This is something that we have a team of people who are wine makers. They actually participate in producing the wine because the handling of the product must be done exclusively by Shomer Shabbos individuals. So that's, it's different. It's not, I don't like to call them mashgichim. They're not mashgichim. I call them kosher workers. They're Shomer Mitzvahs, people who actually roll up their sleeves. They sort of laugh and in wine productions when you get a guy from Kerala and he comes in a white shirt and you're going to come make wine in a white shirt and see how long that white shirt stays white. This is, you know, it's blue-collar work. It's real work and it's physical labor. I think one of the wineries up in Napa Valley, they it's an exclusively kosher winery. They had tours and, you know, someone once said, the winemaker was showing them around. He says, the rabbi does this, and the rabbi does that. The rabbi, you know, the rabbi does, he says, a rabbi and work. He says, isn't that like an oxymoron? But that's really what it is. But in trying to impress upon those who are making the wine, and, you know, the elephant spoke this about meat, but wine is as serious as meat. The Chachma Sadam says words which are, you know, frightening. And he writes here, I'm not going to share the entire piece with you, but he writes that people historically and communities historically were not so careful with kosher wine. And there were, you know, if you look in Paiskin, unfortunately, there were times, periods when people said, what's the big deal? It's not like it's, you know, they used it for Avodah Zarah today. And there were communities where they were very lax in this area. And the The Chacham Sadim quotes from Sifrei Kabbalah. The Chacham Sadim is one of the classic Paiskin. He says, and I'll just mention the last sentence over here in the red, the Kasvu, he's quoting from Sifrei Kabbalah, Shekabbalah b'yodam, they have this b'mesorah, Shashosa stam yenom. If a person drinks wine which is stam yenom, that means he drinks wine which is not kosher, not, you know, used in Avodah Zarah, Yikoshel bevadei livol aramis, he will be involved with an illicit relationship with a non-Jewish woman. Chazal tell us, if you will drink their wine, you will come to marry them. Chazal saw that wine is one of the primary vehicles for social interaction between people. You socialize with people in that context, you will ultimately come to marry them. And Rahmanul Islam, that's what we see. We've seen historically that intermarriage and drinking of wine together was something that were clearly associated one with the other. But it always troubled me. We know that Yayin Nesach is a concept that we're familiar with. And there's a concept called Stam Yayin. Yayin Nesach means that they used to use, the people who worshipped idols, they used to use wine as a libation in their worship. And of course, that's called takrovas avodah zarah. Anything which is used for avodah zarah becomes aser, not just b'shti or achila, but also b'hano. We can't even benefit from that. But what does that have to do with B'nai Seyim? What does that have to do, you know, with Chazal, they said that's not enough, we have to go and... So I found a Pirkei de Rabbi Elazar in Medrash. The Medrash says, who enacted this? Where did this, when did Chazal come up with this new iser of Stam Yenom? And he says, Amad Pinchas, remember Pinchas? Pinchas the Kanoi? This was after the events that happened with Ibn Ismidya. What happened with Ibn Ismidya? They enticed Jewish men, these non-Jewish women, to be with them and to worship Avodah Zarah that they had at that time. Pinchas is the one who established the Isser. We think of, you know, Stam Yenom, Chazal, Zeres that come maybe hundreds of years after Tanakh. No, the Medrash says it was Pinchas who established this Zera. And he says because wine is something that you come to marry them, you'll come to worship with them. Avodah Zarah and marriage go together. If you interact socially, you'll come to marry and you'll come to worship. That's what happens with people. And that's what we see. They see that if you want to be shomer and taharas hakodesh of Klal Yisrael, that Klal Yisrael should remain the kedusha, then that's what's required. It's required to have these separations. Machal Yakum is not exclusively for wine, but primarily perhaps with wine. And Chazal saw that if we were lax in this area, then it's slippery slope, so-called, that this is what it leads to. And then when you put together a team of Shomer Shabbos people who will make wine, we try to impress upon them what we're talking about. We're not just talking about, you know, you're going to make the wine and you'll do the work. We're talking about Klal Yisrael. We're talking about the Kedusha of Klal Yisrael. And dependent on their work, and it's not just exclusively in wine, but in this area, if they do their jobs properly, then Klal Yisrael will maintain its Kedusha. Rahman al-Islam, if that doesn't happen, then we unfortunately know what the results can be. I want to share with you a short video. This video was filmed in South Africa. There's a Rav there who's, we work on a couple of projects together with. His name is Rabbi Mizels. He's the Dayan in Cape Town. And he created a video together with one of the wineries. It's no longer wineries, it's now defunct. But in it, he describes, and there's a little bit of video to show you what it looks like. It's a little bit grainy, so that's why it's a small picture, but that's the best I have at this point. No sound.
Okay. All right. So it's not that important. We'll just I'll just run through the video. Maybe I'll give you a little narrative. These, of course, are vineyards. This is where the grapes grow. People come to harvest, and we'll talk a little bit further about the harvesting. What you see here is a lot of human labor, physical labor, and this is not done by mashgiach, our kosher workers. They don't go out into the field. And we'll talk a little bit about why that would or would not be an issue. That's a question that often comes up in these presentations. That's Rabbi Mazel's talking. That's a question that comes up, is why don't you have to actually go out to the vineyards? This is the grapes falling into the receiving bin. Those grapes are then going to be processed. Of course, there are different types of grapes. Rabbi Mazel's is perhaps describing that the fact that it's only Shomer Shabbos workers who can be involved in this process once the grapes come in. Then there's machinery that moves the grapes from position to position. When obviously it's an extraction process, those grapes end up in what they call fermentation tanks, where, what is wine? You think about it. What's the difference between wine and grape juice? Grape juice is the sugar-filled juice, which is, when you crush the grapes, you end up with a very sweet juice. Wine is when you take that sugar, which is in the grape juice, and you ferment it, and that turns into alcohol. The fermentation process is these little microbial organisms that will ferment and change the sugar into alcohol. That's why wine is no longer sweet. Why some wine is sweet, that's a different conversation. But we'll talk about that a little bit later. After that process, the fermentation, you now have this alcoholic beverage, which has a level of alcohol. It's then aged for a period of time, sometimes in stainless steel tanks, sometimes in new barrels. And then ultimately the product will be bottled, sometimes it's also mevushel, and we'll talk about those issues as well. So we'll move on from here. I'd like to actually walk through some of the steps. So the first step, when you come to a winery that our kosher workers are involved with, is receiving of the grapes. Now, grapes come in different sizes. Sometimes you have an exclusive winery that's receiving very small bins that are hand-picked. They baby them. Sometimes I joke with them. I said, halavai, you treated your children the way you treat the grapes. And some of these wineries, they mamish, they take care of the grapes, to make sure nothing chalila happens to them. But in other cases, especially in large industrial operations, they come in trucks such as you see in this picture. Big truck, which, the truck just dumps all the grapes out, tons of grapes at one time. Then it moves into something called a destemmer. What the destemmer does is it removes the stems. Grapes grow on stems. It removes them and removes the leaves, because when you process them, you don't want the bad flavor that would come from the wood to get into the juice. So you try to get rid of those as quickly as possible. Beyond that, depending if it's a red wine, which you press later, or whether it's a white wine, which you press immediately, it goes through a press. This is a modern-looking press that you see one of our workers standing in front of, and that basically fetches the juice and separates it from the grapes, or the skins and the pits. Fermentation tanks come in various sizes, depending on, again, whether it's a big industrial operation or whether it's a small boutique winery. And this is where the conversion of the sugar into alcohol takes place. The aging takes place sometimes in wood, sometimes in stainless steel. The product goes through filtration. This is what a filter looks like on the outside. This is what a filter looks like on the inside. And in order to clean it out properly, you need to open up these filters to make sure that they're properly cleaned before you start a kosher production. When you're making basically only wines that are pasteurized or kosher wines, they go through a heating process. The heating, in this case, goes through pipes which have hot water on the outside and the wine on the inside. And we have to make sure that the temperatures that we require for Bishul are being achieved. Finally, the product goes through a bottling machine, and the corks are seal the bottles. So what is it about grapes? When you have grapes, such as one of our people standing in front of a grape, he's holding a cluster of grapes, they're as kosher as any fruit is. And in fact, sometimes when you talk to companies, you talk to non-Jews, they don't understand the concept. What is this with grape juice? Grapes, oranges, apples. This is the simplest of fruits, and you press them and you get the juice. So the same way that apple juice is a very simple product, what's this about grapes? So the grapes themselves, you go into a store and you pick up a cluster of grapes.
You want to try one more time?
We put a cluster of grapes. It's about as kosher as you can get. So what's all the sensitivity? I've told a story that I heard from my wife's uncle, who's Rabbi Dr. Twersky. He founded the what's called Gateway Rehabilitation Center, which helps people who have addicted to alcohol, addicted to chemicals, to drugs and the like. And he ran this for many, many years. He's retired since. And they, of course, had all kinds of patients. And he had, at one time, a Catholic priest who was a patient. And this guy was having a very difficult time in the program. And finally, he walks into the office. He says, Rabbi, or doctor, whatever you refer to, he says, that's it, I'm finished, I'm out. He says, you know, he did with many patients. He says, you got to stick with it. It's difficult. There's no question about it. But you got to stick with the program. If you stick with the program, you'll get there. So he says, in any case, he says, I'm a priest. He says, we use wine in the sacrament. And he says, one thing he's always telling all the alcoholics is that they can never touch a sip of alcohol ever again in their life. He says, how am I supposed to act to do this for my job? He says, I have to come in contact with wine. So he says, you know, why don't you use grape juice? He says, grape juice? I never heard of such a thing. He says, we use, you know, for Kiddush, we use also for our services, we use wine, and we use grape juice instead. He says, I never heard of such a thing. He says, we ask a Shiloh, you know. So they posed the question to the place, I think the cardinal in Pittsburgh, which is where this happened. He says, I never heard of such a Shiloh. He says, I have to go and ask, you know, to the higher authority. So they sent the Shiloh back to Rome. And ultimately, whoever makes the decision, the Paschans, the Shiloh's over there, said, listen, the grape juice is good enough for the Jews, it's good enough for us. But, you know, the reality is, grapes are kosher. There's nothing wrong with grapes. Once you have what's called hamshacha, hamshacha is a separation, and this is the way the Shulchan Aruch describes it. Memesai nikra yain. Why is it called wine? When does this simple, innocuous grape become all of a sudden the most sensitive, and even kosher meat can be touched by a non-Jew. Even, you know, fish, it can be touched by them. This is something, you can't touch it. He says, when does it become yain? He says, le'asu d'magav t'michav, that if a guy comes in contact with it, that it becomes asur. That's mishihischa li'moshech. That's when there's a separation. That means there's a flow of juice. Mishinimshech ala gas be'atzmoy ki agas v'madrim. He says, the gas, that's a press. A press is an incline, and in that, what you have is the grapes being pressed, and then you have a flow of juice. So this is what an ancient press looks like. The excavating of the global excavations in Eretz Yisrael, this is what it looks like. It's basically two pits dug into the ground, and you'll notice there's a canal which connects the two. So in the upper pit, they would put the grapes. I don't know if they used their bare feet or whatever they used to press it. But they would press it, and then slowly the juice would seep down that canal into the lower pit. That's your gas. That's what it was. Update that by a couple of hundred years, and this is what it looked like. It was a stone which had on top, and it had an area for the juice to collect, and it would drop down into that stone bucket that you see beneath it. That's basically what a gas looked like, and this is the same concept. Update that by another 1,000 or so years, and you have these baskets in which the grapes sit. And there's these machines that push down on the grapes, and the juice goes through the holes in the baskets, and that's your grape juice coming out. So we ask the question, well, what about in the vineyards? Is there no hamshacha? Is there no separation that ever takes place in the vineyards? So this is a video. They have, obviously, hand-picked grapes. It's not really much of a shadow. Because hand-picked grapes, it's handled by human beings. It's usually done with a certain delicacy. However, when you have machine harvesting, and that's usually not for the fancy wines, that's usually for the more industrial type, this is what it looks like. This is a sort of like a tractor which runs right over the vines, and it picks the grapes from the vineyards. Okay, that itself, what's the problem? But here what you do is you can see the result of it, and you can see the way it pours the grapes. It pours it down. Now look at all that juice, and look at all the grapes that are following it. So the question here is that considered hamshacha? Is that juice, or is that considered grapes? So the Paiskim say that this is considered grapes, it's not considered juice. Why? Because there's not a separation. You have juice, you have a lot of liquid, and inevitably when you have a big truck with tons of grapes, there's a certain amount of pressing that's happening by itself, because juice is, you know, the grapes, the weight of the grapes is bringing about a certain extraction of juice. But the reality is that this is all together, it's never separated, and that's the key. When we look at grapes coming in, what we look at is there a basket that has holes that's being collected someplace, or is just any juice just going to waste? That's the definition of hamshacha versus non-hamshacha. Typically, we'll only work with a winery that does not have hamshacha until the grapes actually come in and begin the process in the winery, because it's not practical. I'm told that in Eretz Yisrael, they actually have, in some places, Shabbos workers out in the fields, out in the vineyards. It's not practical in Chutzlartz, and if there's an issue, we would just avoid that type of winery altogether. When grapes come in, the Shulchan Aruch does say that the pouring or the dumping of the grapes into the gas, this is even before the process begins, should be done by Yisrael. So, in this case, this is in Argentina. Mendoza is the place where they grow grapes in Argentina, one of the primary places. In their summertime, which is, or before their summertime, and here it's sometimes like 110 degrees Fahrenheit, which is very uncomfortable. And they also sometimes have trucks which don't have lifts. And sometimes we have mashkichim actually rolling up their sleeves in this heat, and they're shoveling off. This is done typically by, you know, minimum wage menial laborers, and sometimes at least they participate in this process. It's not clear whether this is a gas or not, but this is something that has happened in the past. Now, the bin where the grapes are received. Now, again, typically speaking, there is no hamshacha. So this can be done. It's not really a gas, but so this is what it looks like. You dump the grapes, and this cork screw, the screw, moves the grapes on to the next process. But if you take a closer look, look carefully, what do you see underneath the screw? What you saw there is little holes. There's a screen there. In this particular case, we had a problem, because this is already a place where hamshacha takes place. Because the grapes, there's a certain amount of juice which is going through the screen and is being collected. This is where hamshacha takes place. So many times, even this early stage of the process, even the receiving of the grapes, already involves hamshacha and has to be done by the Yisrael. A lot of our kosher workers are not trained as forklift drivers. And forklifts can be dangerous unless you know what you're doing. So how do we, if the dumping takes place with the forklift, which it often does, how do we deal with it? So this is just a short video. It shows a mashkiach.
He's from Muncie.
Oh, he's from Muncie?
Young camera. Is that young?
No, it's not young. Okay. What he's doing is he's standing next to the driver, and he's operating the lever. He doesn't have to know how to drive the forklift. He has to know how to operate the lever to dump the grapes. So here we have the swell who's actually standing right next to him, and he makes sure that he's the one to do this and not the non-Jew who's driving the forklift. That's, you know, you see the bin. Okay, so now you have sound. There's no more sound in this presentation, but okay. Thank you. Moving on. Once the product, the product from this point on, every last movement, every manipulation, every sampling, every anything is going to be done by Yisrael. It's not done by a non-Jew, because otherwise Maga Akum is going to make the wine non-kosher. Until it's in a sealed vessel. What is a sealed vessel? It depends. Here's a mashgiach, or kosher worker, whatever you call him. He's standing next to a large tank. And if you notice closely, each inlet and outlet has a seals on it. It has tape with signatures, with dates, Hebrew names. Those are the seals of the simanim that are on the tanks. There's a close-up of what a particular seal looks like. It's taped up, and he writes all those details on it. This is a siman muvuk, and therefore nobody can touch, nobody can move product in or out of the tank once it's like this. This is what a barrel would look like sometimes. You use tape, and he signs the tape as well. And this way, you can have wine sitting in that barrel, and usually they use better things to different types of lead seals or different types of seals. They're plastic seals with numbers on it that come from the OU that are printed by the OU. But this is the idea. And of course, when the product is in the bottle and it has a capsule on top and has a cork on top of it, it has a siman muvuk on it. Therefore, you can buy the product and it's not a problem. What about yain mevushel? Typically speaking, yain mevushel, non-kosher wine is never mevushel. Why? Because the way the Ebreshter made it, why did they make wine? Because this is a beverage that you could preserve. How do you preserve it? You don't need to preserve it. You take wine, it has enough alcohol in it that it preserves itself. That's why wine doesn't spoil. Take juice and leave it outside for a week and you can have a spoiled product. Wine, because of the alcohol content, does not spoil. However, so because of that, there's no reason to pasteurize. They pasteurize milk or juice or all these products. They're doing so to get the bacteria out so it shouldn't spoil. But since wine doesn't need this, they don't pasteurize it typically. What is the level of pasteurization? Rav Moshe in a tshuva writes that bishul, mevushal, to call something mevushal, it has to reach something called yad soledes. Yad soledes is a concept we're familiar with from Shabbos. We won't, you know, of course, cook something up to a point which should reach yad soledes, where a person has to remove his hand from it, he can't hold his hand on the product. However, that said, we typically use much lower temperatures for Shabbos than we do for what Rav Moshe prescribes for bishul for wine. And there's a reason for that, because yad soledes is not a temperature, there's no specific temperature. Yad soledes is a range. It depends on the person, there's an average person, depends on the person's, some people are more sensitive to heat, some are less sensitive to heat. So for Shabbos, typically we're machmer down to about 115, 120 degrees Fahrenheit. But for yayin, to determine that it's definitely mevushal, Rav Moshe writes that it should reach 175 degrees Fahrenheit, and that's the position that the OU uses. There are others who say that yad soledes is insufficient. There are some voices who say that it has to be malo v'sicha. It means it has to really come to a boiling point, and they want temperatures which are closer to the boiling of about 200 or so degrees. But this is the OU relies on this tshuva of Moshe, and that's what we have typically do. Typically we look for higher temperatures anyway, because these machines, you know, they have fluctuation. So we want to have a good comfort zone, about 5 or 10 degrees more, so that we make sure it doesn't. And that's something that actually you need a mashgiach standing and watching, because these things do fluctuate, and making sure that it continues to maintain those temperatures. Another question that comes up often, and particularly we get these questions from Spartan, is how much water do they add into the wine? How much juice concentrate do they add into the wine? You mentioned before, when you buy wine, typically wine is dry. Dry, when I say dry, it's wet, but it's dry, meaning it's not sweet. Why is wine dry? Why is it not sweet? Because what happens in the conversion process, the sugar which was in the grape juice has converted into alcohol. So how is it that you have all this sweet wine? Where does it come from? Anise? No, it's not anise. What's happening is one of a few things. I'll give an example. There's a wine I think some people may even have on their Shabbos tables called the blue bottle, Moscato, the Bartanura. So that product, if you take a look at it, it comes from a very sweet grape, a Muscat grape. It holds only 5% alcohol. The typical wine is about 12, 13, 14, 15%. It's only 5%. So what happens? They ferment it. It's a very sweet grape as it is. They ferment it and they stop the fermentation. So they convert a certain amount of the sugar into alcohol, but then they stop it. So there's what's called residual sugar in the product. So you also have late harvest wines for the same reason. They have so much sugar in them that even though they ferment it to a certain extent, they have residual sugar left behind. There are, of course, other sweet wines which are sweetened by adding something to make it sweet. So how does that happen? If you have, let's say, the cream Malaga, which says sweetened, they add sugar, and that's how they make it sweet. If you have what's called the naturally sweetened, they're adding something called grape juice concentrate. So they can call it naturally, so it's not sugar, it's not a separate type of material, but it is, it's a foreign product to this wine that's added to make it sweet, otherwise the product would be dry. Now, the question is, once you start playing with the wine, and it's no longer 100% single strength juice converted into alcohol, how much do they have? Now, this I can tell you, what I've been advised, I can't say I have this first-hand knowledge, but I've been advised that every OU product that's available in the market has, that means kiddush wines. I'm not talking about industrial juice, which is used for other purposes. But every OU product, whether it's in this country or whether it's from Eretz Yisrael, has at least, the very minimum, 51% of single-strength juice in it. Which means that according to the Sfardim, we're more machmir by Ashkenazim, we can tolerate a lot of even water added to our wine. We can tolerate, it only has to be 1/6. But for the Svardim, it has to be at least 50%. So everyone, I'll give you an example. There's a wine called Sangria. Sangria is a Spanish type of wine. And by definition, Sangria is half wine and half water, flavors, sugar. That's how this product is made. When we made Sangria, we went out of our way to increase the amount of wine in it above 50% so that we can achieve always having wine. Even in Eretz Yisrael, where a lot of this, you know, especially the low end wines in Eretz Yisrael, there's a lot more mixing and adding of flavors and sugars and other things. What I've been told by our staff in Eretz Yisrael is that OU products do not have the situation where you ever have less than 50%. I can't say that for every kosher wine in the world, particularly from Eretz Yisrael, but that's what I'm told for. And even, for example, this question is often asked, what are the Kedem Light? Kedem Grape Juice Light is a product which has, obviously, grape juice. It also has a small amount of concentrate added, and it also has water and aspartame, which is the artificial sweetener. People who, for either dieting reasons or because of diabetic or whatever it is, can't have sugar, would want to use this type of product. I'm told that this product also has, at the minimum, it has more than that, but it has at the very minimum 50%, 51% of single-strength juice in it. There's another issue, which is the concentrating. Some places can say that concentrated juice is no longer considered like wine, so therefore it cannot be included to reach the 51%. And that's the statement that I just said applies as well for just single strength, which means the original juice, not concentrate, not certainly water, sugar, or any other substance. And this is actually a tshuva from Shlomo Zalman, where Shlomo Zalman Auerbach talks about juice concentrate as not being wine. He doesn't say it in Taras Vada, he says it he's in doubt as to whether something which is concentrated can be considered. Rabelski from ELU has a tshuva arguing otherwise, it means rice otherwise, but that's basically that situation. So I'd like to move now, I suspect there may be some interest about other fine beverages, not just wine. So we'll talk a little bit about schnapps. And as far as schnapps are concerned, let me just break it down. Anything which is a liqueur, that means a sweet type of beverage, has a certain amount of alcohol, it has obviously sugar or sweet, something to sweeten it, and it has flavors. The OU's position, and this has become, I think, the widespread position of all the kashrus agencies, is that flavored products that contain complex compound flavors require hashgacha. So the same way you wouldn't buy a beverage or any other food product which has flavors in it without hashgacha, a liqueur needs hashgacha. Obviously, you have to know that the alcohol is kosher, you have to know that the equipment on which it's processed is kosher, but that product invariably requires hashgacha. There are, of course, some of the Martinur brands or even some of the national brands. If you have a product such as Amaretto di Sirona or off the top of my head, there are many liqueurs which have hashgacha, and one should obviously look for those types of products with hashgacha. What about liquor? That means not liqueur, but liquor. Liquor is the hard stuff. That's the stuff that has a higher alcohol content, and there are many products that fall into this category. There's vodka, there's bourbon, there's scotch, there's the whiskeys from Canada or American whiskeys, there's rye, there's gin, there's a whole host of different types of products which are normally higher alcohol content. Typically, these do not have flavors. I can't say always. Typically, they don't have flavors in them. And the reality is that when we come to Shul and Shabbos, when we go to a simcha, we will see many of these products gracing the tables, and they don't have hashgacha. And I'd like to talk a little bit about what are some of the issues, what are some of the concerns, and whether they are concerns or they're not concerns. And certainly, I think there's a reality, as Rabbi Elephant mentioned before, if the consumer is not looking for hashgacha, they're not going to find hashgacha. If people are not going to want hashgacha, and they're not going to demand hashgacha, that means when they come into a liquor store and they say, I'd like to buy this, but why doesn't it have hashgacha? Rest assured, it will not have hashgacha, because it's all consumer driven. If we demand something, then the companies will respond. That said, I'm not going to here to tell you that you must have hashgacha on these products. I'm not going to tell you that if you come to a kiddush, in fact, I love to share it. There's a tshuva from Rav Moshe Feinstein where he talks about blended whiskey. And it's not so much for the halacha, but what he writes afterwards is you know, I find fascinating. He's talking about a liquor product that had some wine, non-kosher wine, blended into it. It was a very small amount, probably about maybe 1/40th or 1/50th of the product. That wasn't bottle b'shishim, but it was bottle b'sheishim. Moshe writes that mitzad ha-din, that product is permissible. He says, however, Moshe Feinstein says, I personally, I'm achmer, I would not take from this product, I would not drink it. Except, he says, if I come to a kiddush or come to a simcha, and this type of product is on the table, which is mitzad ha-din, it's mutter. And he says, people are drinking together, and I don't want to demonstrate, you know, that I'm not part of the chabura. He says, then I will. You know, that's sort of the attitude that Rav Moshe Feinstein had in terms of, you know, he wants to be scrupulous in what he did, but that said, he didn't want to separate himself from the chabura. But again, people have to use their judgment in terms of how they interact. Today, Baruch Hashem, there are some products of this nature which have hashtacha. Certainly, people are encouraged to use those. Not that you have to make a scene in shul, and like Rav Moshe didn't make a scene in shul. What is the process for these types of liquors? So let's go through the process step by step. The first step is you're taking typically a grain. What is the grain? The grain can be wheat, it can be rye, it can be corn. Although we don't call corn grain as far as chametz is concerned, but it's, you know, colloquially it's called grain. What you do is you take that and it undergoes a germination process. And it's a temperature controlled process where what you're doing is you're separating the starches. There are a lot of starches in grains. And what you want to do is you want to bring about a separation of those starches. After that, you mix it with hot water and you have what's called the mash. And what you're doing here is you're converting the starch into sugar. This is a process that happens naturally. Sometimes they will add enzymes. Enzymes should have hashgacha. I'm not going to tell you that b'dieved it needs hashgacha in this case, but it undergoes this process that it's only assisting in the process. It's certainly bottled. But that enzyme, what you're doing is you're creating a sugar substance. Because in order to make alcohol, you got to start with sugar. After that, you ferment it the same way we discussed for wine. And the fermentation is usually with the addition of yeast. And that converts the sugar into an alcohol. However, alcohol will only make 14-15% alcohol. Then it stops. That's what happens. Naturally, the alcohol is created, and then it kills itself. It kills the bacteria. Once you reach a certain level of alcohol, it's like a disinfectant. It will kill the bacteria, so it stops. So how do you get from the 14-15% alcohol up to the 40-50-60% that you have in the schnapps? That's what's called distillation. Distillation is a cooking process where you separate the water or the other non-alcohol from the alcohol. So what you're doing is you're bringing up the concentration. You can actually bring it up to Sachsen-Einziger, familiar with the term. Why is it called Sachsen-Einziger? Because 96% is the highest you can get. Once you get to 96%, you'll never get any higher. You can distill it from, you know, today till next year. You will never get above 96%. And that's why, you know, Sachsen-Einziger is what they used to drink, because that was the highest you can get it up to. That distillation, not always will you go up to 96%, because that's a neutral grain spirit. If you want to maintain some of the extra character flavor of the bourbon or the scotch or whatever it is, you don't go that high, because you want to keep that flavor profile. So this is the distillation. After that, it's a maturation process. So basically what we've discussed till now doesn't present any major kashrus issues. There's really nothing. This is where we get into some of the more concern. This is the maturation. Maturation is they put it into barrels. In order to give it that unique flavor and profile, what they do is they put it into wooden barrels. I was just a couple of weeks ago, I was in Scotland, and I went to a number of Scotch whiskey plants. So the process of making Scotch requires, this is by law, requires that they take the distilled beverage, the distilled alcohol, and they put it into bourbon casks. It's interesting how these two industries, in Kentucky and in Scotland, are reliant on one another. They can't make enough Scotch as they want in Scotland because they don't have enough barrels from bourbon coming from Kentucky. So this is the way it works. And they pay a lot. They pay quite a bit of money to get these bourbon casks. They will age the product for a period of time. I think the minimum to call it Scotch whiskey is about 3 years, but it will go higher than that. The issue that comes to play is the last process for some of these Scotch whiskies, The last step is they'll take the liquor out of these bourbon casks, which are not a kosher issue, and they'll put them into sherry casks, port casks, all kinds of different things. They experiment with all kinds of different things. And they put it, these, of course, are issues, because these are casks that held sherry as a wine, and port as a wine. So since they hold it in wine casks, you have a Kalim question. So after that, they bottle the product. This picture you see is a company called Glenmorangie. Now, Glenmorangie is a very popular, it's one of the fastest growing scotches, because it has the OU. Actually, the only one that has the OU, you see a number of bottles here, is what's the original. That's the product that's basically 65% of the product is the original. This product is never put into sherry casks. It's only in bourbon casks, and it goes straight to bottling, and it doesn't touch sherry. Some of the other products you see over here will go into sherry casks, the OU doesn't certify. Now, the question is there bittul or is there no bittul? Our pesukim have told us, you know, if you're relying on bittul, the OU is not there. That's not the OU's purpose. The OU's purpose is not to, you know, we don't certify any product that relies on bittul. So, we don't certify any of these products other than the original, or actually there's a second product they make also. There's a third product maybe that's coming out one day of the higher level of their, but they sell for a lot more money. But we don't have that many Scotch whiskies. For two reasons. Because there's a lot of sherry which is involved in the processes. We've had to turn down a number of Scotch whiskey companies for that reason. But I think the primary reason we don't certify more is because, unfortunately, there's not a demand. Because people are just as happy to go and make a simcha using the sherry cask product. And, you know, if that's what their rabbanim recommend for them, I'm not here to criticize. But if there's not an interest from the consumer, then there will not be products that follow. As far as the bittul, I mentioned the tshuva for Moshe, why would sherry casks be mutter? So I'll give you the rationale for it. The reason is, much as we're familiar with the term of bittul b'shishin, that means to nullify something, to make something bittul, you need 1 in 60. That's with respect to tana, that's with respect to that type of a bittul. Stam yenum, because it's only an issur d'rabbanan, I shouldn't say the word only an issur d'rabbanan, it's a very strong issur d'rabbanan, but Chazal determined that it has to be identified as yayin. And since we said for Ashkenazim that even if you add water to wine, it's still considered wine, so only when it's below 1 in 6, that's when there's bittul. When you have 1 in 6, so then you have 6 times as much, that is bittul. That's what Moshe writes in the tshuva. That would be a rationale for saying this. However, the sherry casks have to be very thick. They're very thick, so the reality is, typically, you will not have even shisha in the beverage connected the walls, the thickness, because they're so thick against the walls. So how do you bittul b'shesh? So that's another issue. That's the Shulchan Aruch talks about. Stam yenum will only aser kedei klipa. They don't aser the entire thickness of the wall. They only aser the outside. There are different poskim. There's a shach. I'm not here to discuss the whole discussion. But those who want to be machmer want to be machmer according to the poskim. You say that it's not. It's more than a klipa. Not getting into a whole halacha discussion. But that's basically the rationale for doing that. The OU's position, of course, is that we encourage that people should drink products that don't rely on bittul. There's a tshuva of Rashba that says that bittul is only by kroy, that you don't want to have bittul relied on as a matter of course. It's only something that, by accident, something you know got mixed in, that's when you rely on bittul. And I think Rav Henkin actually wrote in the tshuva, he says that's why he praises the idea of the kashrus agencies not relying on bittul for that reason. Now, to close, just to talk about, we're talking about wine, we're talking about these types of products. Wine especially requires, a mesiris nefesh on the part of mashkichim, or workers, whatever we call them. The wine regions are not necessarily close to where there are Jewish communities, and it happens to be that wine, the time of the season for the harvest, always falls out Yom Tov time. So, typically. So it's always in the fall, and even in the southern hemisphere, that's Pesach, their fall, which is spring, is Pesach. So that means people, and that we've had people who've spent Yom Tov away from home, they've built sukkahs in these places, and sometimes they spend, there are people who actually, are most nefesh to make kosher wine, to get it from the vineyards into the bottle that we use. It's not one person who's involved, it's a team of people. This is a standard team that would work in a winery. I think the man in the middle is one of our big wine munchen. He's actually, he hails from Muncie, Rabbi Yoni Cantor. Although we're in Suffern, it's pretty close. But the OU is making wine literally all over the world. We're making, of course, in Eretz Yisrael, we're making wine in New York State, we're making wine in California, in Oregon, in Washington State, we're making in France, we're making in Italy, in Spain, we're making in, we made once in Georgia, and this is actually, I think, in Austria. There's wine made in Australia, both coasts of Australia, both the eastern coast and the western coast. We make wine in places like South Africa, in places like Argentina and Chile. Where else is there wine? There's wine made in, it was years ago in Georgia, not south, but Georgia, the former Soviet Republic, is also a wine region. We make wine there. That's basically what goes into making wine. If there are questions, try to close any time. I'll try to answer those questions. Thank you very much for listening.
One question which came from the audience. You showed a picture of a barrel which had OU tape. The person is asking, the OU tape seemed to easy to remove and replace. How can that serve as a symbol?
That tape is purchased specially by the OU because it's not easy to remove. It can be removed, but if it's put back, it will not. It's tamper-proof. It's specifically my product, which is tamper-proof, and that's why we get seals. We get other things. Sometimes it looks flimsy, but the reality is that we get products. That's also why we sign names on top of it. Also, it's that, you know, if for some reason they can duplicate it. They can't sign the name the same way that the Mashiach would sign. So we use different systems, but we haven't found problems specifically with that type.
Is there any shash of kipniyus in the yeast that is added to the wine?
Yeast, we're familiar with it with the terms of, sour or isa. That's the, sourdough. That's obviously a yeast which grows on hummus. And it has a didn't like hummus. But yeast is a bacteria. Yeast can grow on many things. Your Red Star yeast that you buy can grow on kidneys and grow on it. The wine yeast that are used have special hashgacha for Pesach. The chashos said not just hummus or kidneys, which they don't have, there are also chashos that grow on grapes, which can be non-kosher. So we avoid those as well. So the yeast is a bacteria, and depending on the medium that you grow it on, that will determine the status of this yeast.
Someone asked if the American bourbons need hashgacha.
All bourbon is American. Bourbon is a product that is made, it can be bottled all over the country, and it is bottled all over the country, but it's made specifically in Kentucky, and by law, if I'm not mistaken, it has to be 51% corn. The rest can be rye, it can be wheat and the other types of grains, but it's a U.S. product.
In Eretz Yisrael, the workers need to be shomer shabbos.
Absolutely.
Okay. Let's just see. Okay. I think we're running late, so I think we're going to ask Rabbi. Schreiber, no, I'm going to ask Rabbi Elkin a few last questions. Okay. Rabbi Elkin, there's a store in Muncie selling cooked meat product with a firm employee selling the meat product. 2 feet away is the identical non-kosher product sold by a regular non-Jewish clerk. The kosher product has a hetcher, not the OU. What is the OU's position on this situation?
Ronald Reagan said that the first law to be a Republican is never speak bad about another Republican. So the first law of a Rav in Hashgacha is never speak bad about another Rav in Hashgacha. So I'm not here to speak about other Rabbanim in Kashrus. All I could say is that the OU did not give such Hashgacha.
Is it okay to have the Mashgiach Tamidi sitting on the side or working himself in food preparation?
Excellent question. A mashgiach in an operation should be involved in the operation. You know, when I came to the OU many years ago, we had mashgiachim, and the position at that time was that mashgiachim should not do anything besides being mashgiachim. And what happened was, because they shouldn't be doing anything besides being mashgiachim, they weren't doing anything. And they were sitting in the back reading the Yiddish newspaper. And who knows what was going on in the kitchen while they were doing it. So we actually sort of modified it. And we modified it for many reasons. We modified it that mashgiachim should be involved in doing something, because if they're going to be involved in doing something, then they're more likely to know what's going on. But there were a number of conditions. And there was another reason. If the mashgiach is going to be involved in the operation, it's going to be easier for us to demand, and they're still not overpaid by any stretch of imagination, but it'll be easier for us to demand a better salary for them. And if you get a better salary, you can get a better person. So we do have the mashgiachim involved in the operation. However, number one, their first responsibility always has to be kashrus. And number two, they're going to be involved in the operation, provided it's in a respectful manner. So we would never let the mashgiach be the one to mop the floor or do something like that. But if it's something that's respectful, we find it actually to be a minor.
The final question is a health issue question. Why does the OU certified drink such as Coke and candy produced by Mars that have been proven by the CDC, NIH, and American Dental Association to contribute to dental disease and heart disease?
It's a good question. It's a very good question. However, you know, we live in a country that has a lot of different agencies.
By the way, Mr. Bloomberg wrote this question.
But he's not the mayor of Muncie. No. Well, now he's becoming mayor of Muncie. He finished with us. So the reality is, everybody should do what they do best. And the OU does not take responsibility for the health of any product. That's not our line of experience. And we don't claim that it should be our line of experience. And that's what we rely on the government for. And although all these different abbreviations that I don't even know what they stand for might have said that these different food items are indeed not healthy, and they probably aren't healthy, but that's not the area of the kashrus agency. The area of the kashrus agency is to deal with kashrus. It's the area of the government. We live in a great country, and they're the ones that are doing that type of monitoring. And of course, if there was a product that was illegal or something that the government tells us we should refrain from, you know, the OU has been asked many times over the years to certify cigarettes. And we've never certified cigarettes. In fact, we just got a call less than 2 weeks ago to certify, they have the electronic cigarettes now, to certify electronic cigarettes, which we also declined, because that's something that says in every package, don't use, so don't use.
All right, thank you very much. And I'd like to thank Rabbi Elf, Rabbi Bitteritz from Schlottinghaus and Borchardt. And have a good night. Again, if anyone would like to order educational kashrus materials, we have them available here at this store, and we'll be happy to fill your order. Thank you, and have a good vote.